Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker. A Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. Florida United Businesses Association. FUBA is a statewide trade association representing Florida businesses. FUBA also publishes The Advisor, a pocket-sized guide to the Florida legislature. More at fuba.org. And from the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 900,000 union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. WFSU FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
The Florida House expresses its take on higher education, including some tweaks to such things as Bright Futures scholarships.
Students make determinations based off circumstance. They all aren't pledging fraternities. They all aren't drinking beer.
Also tonight, House members likewise looking at tightening the requirements for cash assistance programs.
We want people to comply. We want people to be able to go out and find gainful employment.
We'll also find out why failing to stop for a school bus with flashing red lights could start bringing an even bigger punishment, and how some lawmakers are hoping hemp might replace citrus as the state's top cash crop. I'm Tom Flanagan. It's day two of week three for the Florida 2017 lawmaking session, and this is Capitol Report. The Florida House is promising some big cuts to higher education funding, and it has a few more changes in mind for the state's colleges and universities. Lynn Hatter reports those revelations came this week in response to one of Senate President Joe Negron's top priorities.
Senate President Joe Negron wants to make many changes to the way Florida's public higher education system operates. That includes increasing the value of the state's tuition scholarship program, revamping the metrics used to evaluate college and university performance, and tweaking how those schools operate. The Senate okayed its version of the plan earlier in session. Now it's the House's turn, and the chamber has a proposal of its own. Instead of just mirroring the Senate, Republican Representative Brian Avila says his measure offers some alternatives.
It revises the state university system performance-based incentive to include both four-year and six-year graduation rates, as well as access metrics that include success rates of low-income students.
Avila's bill also allows all Bright Futures recipients, not just the top tier, to use their scholarships to cover summer courses. And he would also continue using a six-year graduation rate metric in addition to a four-year metric as one of the criteria for judging colleges and universities. That's important, Representative Ramon Alexander. Florida A&M University is both his alma mater and it's in his district. And Alexander worries the changes could hurt the school, which serves a large number of low-income students and where less than 15% of them met the four-year graduation rate.
Almost 90% of the students at Florida A&M University are on need-based aid. Over 90% of the students at the University of Florida are on Bright Futures. There are a lot of dynamics, and I keep hearing the whole package of suggesting that it will save students money. Yes, on one end, but we're not taking into account the other end. And the other end is that students make determinations based off circumstance. They all aren't pledging fraternities. They all aren't drinking beer.
Lawmakers in the House's post-secondary committee have other concerns, and most center around the issue of block tuition. The Senate wants the state's universities to establish block tuition policies that would allow students to take more classes for a flat rate. But Representative Carlos Guillermo Smith worries there are some students for whom that would mean they would pay more, not less.
Block tuition, I think that remains to be seen because I'm not clear on exactly how many students will be able to take advantage of the block tuition benefit, because I'm thinking of how many students will be able to have time to take more than 15 credit hours, and I'm thinking maybe not that many.
The point of a block tuition policy is to help students get through school faster. On a tour of Florida's public universities, students repeatedly told Senate President Joe Negron that one of their main obstacles toward graduation is financial. Meanwhile, David Armstrong, president of Broward College, worries about part of the bill that would hold colleges responsible for the performance of their students at universities.
For us to implement meaningful change, it takes years sometimes in large structured organizations to affect those changes. And it involves lots of things that are outside of our control. Students make decisions when they go away to universities that we have no control over. I assure you what fraternity they join and how much beer they drink on Friday night that sometimes ends up sending them back home before they get a degree.
And another key difference between the chamber's bills is how they treat low-income students. The House measure would reward schools for recruiting and retaining more of those students, but that's not a feature of the Senate's proposal. The House committee has approved the measure with the majority of members in support, and Avila calls the bill a work in progress. He says the chamber will continue to modify its plan as it makes its way through more committees. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter in Tallahassee.
The Florida House is considering legislation that would strip hundreds of thousands of Florida children from the public assistance rolls. But critics say lawmakers are focused on punishing the poor when they should be trying to create high-wage jobs. More from Sarah Mueller.
Tallahassee Mayor and gubernatorial candidate Andrew Gillum is in the Capitol delivering a pile of signatures asking Speaker Richard Corcoran not to cut more than 157,000 kids from food stamps. Legislation by Republican Representative Frank White sends Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, eligibility requirements back to pre-recession levels. Gillum says his parents worked and got public assistance when he was growing up. He says legislation like this shames people who can't afford to buy all the food they need for their families.
We're in various parts of this state. We have what could be equivalent to developing worlds right in our own state, where families are living in shanties, where their heating and cooling bill is off the charts because their homes lack insulation.
A legislative analysis estimates 229,000 Floridians would lose benefits if the bill becomes law. 44,000 of them would be seniors. Meanwhile, legislation proposed by Cape Coral Republican Representative Dane Eagle increases the time people in the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program are ineligible for cash benefits for not meeting work requirements. Eagle says he wants to align the penalties of TANF and SNAP, but children would continue getting the help. Karen Woodall is with the Center for Fiscal and Economic Policy. She opposes measures limiting benefits because she says lawmakers are only focused on penalizing people.
As you know, there are several bills moving that address public assistance, and they seem to be focused on punishment for noncompliance or going back to the status we were in pre-recession.
Eagle's proposal increases the first sanction from 10 days to 1 month. The second sanction grows to 3 months, and the third becomes 6 months. Recipients who get a fourth violation would be ineligible for benefits for a year. Woodall says Florida sanctioned more than 16,000 Floridians last year for the first time. Less than half of them regained their benefits after being sanctioned. She says a big challenge for people is that they can't find employment. State workforce reports show that just 14% of the people who were on public assistance in 2013 to 2014 found a job, and most earn under minimum wage. Former recipients also face barriers to employment like a lack of education or mental illness. Eagle says he's not trying to be harsh.
I want to be clear that we're trying to help people. We're not trying to punish people, as was mentioned in testimony. We want people to comply. We want people to be able to go out and find gainful employment.
A federal study shows that strategies that improve workforce outcomes combine educational and vocational training. Outcomes also improved with increased competency in soft skills like getting along with people and problem solving. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sarah Mueller.
Legislation now moving at the state capitol would expand the use of ignition interlock devices in cars driven by drunk driving offenders. Under an amended measure that unanimously passed the House Transportation and Infrastructure Subcommittee today, courts could offer first-time DUI offenders probation to include 6 months of required use of an ignition interlock device. Upon successful completion, first-time offenders who do not hurt another person or cause property damage could have their DUI records sealed. This means the person would not have to report the incident on forms like job applications, but police could still see the record if the person is again pulled over for driving drunk. Mothers Against Drunk Driving, or MAD, says ignition interlocks are one of the best ways to keep impaired drivers off the roads. 28 states and Washington, D.C. currently require people to use interlocks to start their cars, beginning with a first drunk driving offense. Statistics provided by MAD say ignition interlock devices have stopped 8,900 drunk driving attempts in Florida over the last year and about 68,000 attempts in the last decade. Still to come on Capitol Report, with the state's signature citrus industry plagued by disease, some lawmakers are wondering if hemp will help boost Florida agriculture.
I believe this is going to be a great project for our state and create another bumper crop, perhaps even to surpass our oranges.
A state senator is taking steps to repeal a long-standing tax credit for insurers. She says that kind of handout wouldn't fly in the legislature today.
What we would call today corporate welfare and a subsidy would not have a snowball's chance in Florida.
While many lawmakers say it should be up to property owners, firefighters are making the case for more sprinklers in high-rise condominiums.
We have to put firefighters in these buildings that are deteriorating, and the mobility of the people trying to get out of these buildings is our primary concern.
And Florida lawmakers are looking to stiffen the penalties relating to stopped school buses.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org.
Across the country, advocates are pitching hemp as a miracle crop. Some Floridians even think the plant could replace oranges as an agricultural powerhouse. But lawmakers in the Capitol are urging caution, as we hear from Kate Payne.
Hemp has a long history in the United States. George Washington and Thomas Jefferson reportedly grew it on their plantations. During World War II, the federal government urged farmers to boost production in this 1942 film, Hemp for Victory.
But now, with Philippine and East Indian sources of hemp in the hands of the Japanese, and shipment of jute from India curtailed, American hemp must meet the needs of our Army and Navy, as well as of our industries.
But for decades, there was one small hiccup. The government banned hemp alongside marijuana. The plants are closely related. But unlike pot, hemp has only small traces of the key active ingredient, THC. And in recent years, the federal government has lightened up on hemp research.
The reason this bill is necessary is the 2014 Federal Farm Bill authorized states to initiate these research projects. 20 states have done that, Kentucky, West Virginia.
That's Jeff Sharkey, representing Treadwell Nurseries. The bill in question is sponsored by Representative Ralph Mazzullo, a Beverly Hills Republican. Under the plan, universities could see how Florida's climate affects the plant and what market there is for byproducts. Cannabis lobbyist Jody James says hemp is showing up in building materials, cosmetics, grocery stores, and car parts.
Because hemp is so environmentally friendly, and because the end products that you create with the resin from hemp replaces plastisols, if someone you know just bought a new BMW, their dashboard is probably already made from hemp.
The potential benefits of industrial hemp can be dizzying, but the USDA does list the plant as an invasive, and it's not clear how it might affect Florida's ecosystem, which is why Republican Representative Ben Albritton of Bartow wants scientists to do 5 years of research before the state approves commercial growers.
There's risk to being an early adopter. right? It's great to be in the marketplace and be able to get the great price, but there's risk in farming. There's risk. And understanding that risk is important.
But Representative Rick Roth, a Palm Beach Gardens Republican, thinks farmers shouldn't have to wait.
There is a strong need in the agriculture community to find new crops. And as Representative Edwards said, some people can't wait 5 years.
Representative Mizzullo says the plant is largely disease and pest resistant and helps take harmful pollutants out of the soil. His hopes for hemp can hardly be overstated, especially for industry-starved rural areas.
I believe this is going to be a great project for our state and create another bumper crop, perhaps even to surpass our oranges.
But critics hope the promise of a miracle won't cloud lawmakers' judgment. The plan is still awaiting its first hearing in the Senate. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
A decades-old subsidy for the insurance industry is shedding light on differing approaches for cutting taxes in the state. Nick Evans reports a Senate panel approved a plan to plow the money into reducing a business rent tax.
Miami Republican Senator Anna Terry Flores opened her presentation with a history lesson.
In 1987, MTV had just started. They actually played videos.
She's backing a proposal that would do away with a 1987 provision that allows insurers to effectively write off the first 15% of their employees' salaries at tax time.
Back then, we still use words like tax credit. Today, we call those things something different. And we say, we need you to come to the state of Florida. This will be a way to help you come to the state. So guess what? It worked.
Today, Flores argues lawmakers call that kind of tax credit corporate welfare. But Florida Blue lobbyist Paul Sanford says the subsidy isn't just about encouraging employment. It's about keeping rates low. That's because Florida charges a tax on every premium insurers collect. And the 15% subsidy allows them to reduce the amount they owe. Sanford says removing it will send everyone's premiums higher.
The lower the premium taxes are, that is a factor that's included in determining every premium that's charged for an insurance policy. When that is a lower number, premium rates are lower. When you repeal this credit, taxes, premium taxes going up $299.6 million, which means insurance premiums are going up $299.6 million.
Others are invoking one of the Florida legislature's third rails. Associated Industries of Florida and the Chamber of Commerce call the measure a tax increase. But Senate President Joe Negron pushes back.
So every single dollar that is in the tax credit now would go 100% to tax relief to either Florida individuals or businesses. So there would not be any tax increase. I wouldn't support a tax increase.
The Senate panel approved the measure. But the question of where to direct the new tax relief highlights a different longstanding debate. Here's Senator Flores again.
Now, the bill before you has one proposal. The chairman has a different proposal. And I hope that no matter what comes out of this, what we do is that we reflect today's priorities and not the priorities of
her proposal would trade the insurance subsidy for reductions in the communication services tax, a fee on things like cable and cell phones. Lawmakers have already cut the tax by about $500 million in the last 2 years. But ratepayers might not have noticed, because the individual reduction is minimal, less than $2 on a $100 monthly bill. Committee Chair Kelly Sargell offers a different business-targeted proposal. The Lakeland Republican wants to cut the tax Florida charges on commercial leases.
That is something that every business that leases space in the state of Florida has to pay. It's something that many people have been working on for years, and I think that then takes the subsidy and distributes it amongst all the businesses of the state of Florida, and that is the amendment.
The committee agreed with Sargell's suggestion, and the idea is one of the few places where the Senate, House, and governor might find some common ground. In a session so far marked by bitter disputes, it might be the beginning of a negotiation. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
A bill moving through the Florida legislature has firefighters sounding the alarm, and we get that story from Regan McCarthy.
The measure would make several changes to rules for homeowners associations, community associations, and condo associations. But one change that seems to be drawing heat is a plan to exempt existing buildings from a requirement to be retrofitted with so-called emergency life safety systems. Fort Lauderdale Republican Representative George Moritis is sponsoring the bill.
What an emergency life safety system is, you get a point score total,
and they go through the building and they say, you know, if you have a fire alarms, if you have smoke alarms, if you have, you know, extinguishers, you get points for every one of these things.
But Ellen Bogdanoff, a former lawmaker and current representative of several community associations throughout the state, says, as it turns out, emergency life safety system checks are really just a backdoor way of forcing people to install fire sprinklers.
Ultimately, when they score, you never seem to quite make the score unless you put in the sprinkler system.
Bogdanoff says lawmakers passed legislation several years ago intending to let communities decide whether to install sprinkler systems, which she says can cost hundreds of millions of dollars. But William Standard with the American Fire Sprinkler Association says that cost doesn't sound right to him.
Well, it's just not true. 2009 Department of Business and Professional Regulation study did a survey of actual completed retrofits, and they averaged per unit for retrofits of common areas only, averaged about $947.50 a unit.
Standard says even if costs have increased some since then, he's not sure where anyone might get an estimate in the hundreds of millions. And John Pascalone with the Florida Fire Marshals and Inspectors Association says there's data from the state that shows sprinklers save lives. And he says not having them risks residents as well as first responders.
And if you think about that, those residents moved down here 20 and 30 years ago with all their worldly possessions. They were probably in their 50s or 60s. Now they're their 70s, 80s, 90 years old. And we appreciate the fact that they're on a fixed income. But we have to put firefighters in these buildings that are deteriorating, and the mobility of the people trying to get out of these buildings is our primary concern.
But Moritas argues the rights of the property owner should be considered. As it stands now, he says the law amounts to a mandate for many condominiums to spend thousands of dollars. He says his bill repealing that rule makes sense. The bill passed the House Careers and Competition Committee. A similar bill in the Senate has not yet had a hearing. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
With little discussion, the Florida Senate today passed a bill that wades back into redistricting issues. The bill, filed by Senator Travis Hudson, Republican of Elkton, would set guidelines for what happens when redistricting legal cases are unresolved in election years. For instance, it would have the effect of ensuring that legislative boundaries in place at qualifying time would be used in that year's primary and general elections, according to a Senate staff analysis. The bill was filed after long-running legal battles that led to Florida's congressional and Senate districts being redrawn before the 2016 elections. Those legal battles stemmed from the Fair District's anti-gerrymandering standards approved by voters back in 2010. The Republican-dominated Senate voted 24-14 to approve the bill along almost straight party lines. Democratic Senator Audrey Gibson of Jacksonville was the only Democrat who supported the measure. A House version has not been heard in committees. You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, after all these years of public service announcements and ever-stiffening penalties, you might think that no driver would ever, ever pass a stopped school bus that's dropping off kids, right? Sadly, the numbers say you'd be very wrong. A bipartisan push to increase school bus safety passed its first House committee today. Sasha Cordner reports.
Last year, as 16-year-old Cameron Mayhew was walking to a school bus in Fort Myers, a car hit him and he died a day later from his injuries.
The stop sign was out, the lights were on, and he was unfortunately struck and killed. The driver of the vehicle was penalized with a 6-month license suspension and a $1,000 fine. Now, some might say that justice was not delivered that day.
So on behalf of Cameron's parents, Cape Coral Republican Representative Dane Eagle says he filed a bill to try to raise the minimum penalty for someone who strikes and kills or injures someone at a school bus stop. It's called the Cameron Mayhew Act.
The penalties would be a minimum of 120 hours of community service in a trauma center or hospital. The driver would have to participate in a victim's impact panel session. There'd be a fine of $1,500, there'd be a 1-year driver license suspension, and there'd be 6 points on your license. Now, this would be in addition to any other charges that a prosecutor would decide to bring forward, but this would at least be the bare minimum that someone would be delivered if they strike and kill or injured someone at a school bus stop.
Eagle's bill unanimously passed the House Transportation and Infrastructure Subcommittee. Another school bus-related measure that got unanimous approval came from Kissimmee Democratic Representative John Cortez. Citing a 2014 Florida school bus survey, Cortez says stopped school buses were passed more than 9,300 times in a single day.
During these incidents, the buses had red lights flashing and stop signs deployed. According to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, from 2004 to 2013, there were 1,344 people killed in school transportation-related crashes. That is an average of 134 fatalities per year.
And Cortez says current law treats the passing of stopped school buses on the side that kids enter and exit as a civil moving violation, subject to a $200 penalty for first offenses. So his bill raises the penalties.
HB 1427 reclassifies the passing of a stopped school bus on the side that children enter and exit as a reckless driving criminal offense. If found guilty of the first offense, the offender can be subject to $500 fines, imprisonment of up to 90 days, or both. It is hoped that this increased penalty will serve as a greater deterrent to behavior. That puts the lives of our school children at risk.
While Wellington Democratic Representative Matt Wilhite says it's a good bill, he believes it could be improved by including penalties for passing the opposite side of the stop school bus as well.
It talks about the side that the children enter or exit. I think there's still a grave danger for the side that they cross as well. And I know there's that arm, and I would hope maybe you, if possible, you would look at that as well, because the school bus is the object that stopped to protect them. They step out in front of that, away from that, to cross across the secondary lane if possible. And there's still as much danger there as well, too, I think.
And Cortez says he's willing to look into making that change. Meanwhile, the Senate companions to both Cortez and Eagle's bills have not yet had a committee hearing. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Sarah Mueller, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And please join us each weeknight at this time throughout the 2017 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: a grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. Florida United Businesses Association. FUBA is a statewide trade association representing Florida businesses. FUBA also publishes The Advisor, a pocket-sized guide to the Florida legislature. More at fuba.org. And from the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 900,000 union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.